The Guardian.
Sport has the power to change the world. It has the power to inspire. It has the power to unite people in a way that little us does.
It's been a summer of unforgettable sporting moments. Sport's power to transfix and transform has rarely felt more unstoppable. But how can we harness the power of sport to achieve development aims? In this podcast, we'll look at how sport is being used to pursue development goals and bring about real social change. We'll hear success stories from around the world. We'll assess what contribution sports stars can make to development. And we'll find out why major events like the World Cup and the Olympics often fail to deliver on the development benefits they promise. I'm Les Rupanarain, and in this month's Guardian Global Development podcast, we'll explore whether sport plays a useful role in development. We'll start with the most popular sport on the planet, football. When Wales international footballer Craig Bellamy visited Sierra Leone in the summer of 2007, he took with him a carload of footballs. Wherever he found a group of kids enjoying a kickabout with a makeshift ball, he would stop, give them a ball, and join in. He was struck by their talent. But what really hit home was their lack of opportunity.
I went over to Sierra Leone in 2007. I had a couple of friends who were working here, so part of the reason I went to see them. Also, I wanted to see a certain part of Africa, which I haven't really had the opportunity to see before. I went over there just amazed by the warmth of the people, but also their thirst for football. No matter where I went, you know, you'd see a Steven Gerrard shirt or a Lampard shirt, and it was just an incredible experience for me. How football motivates these young kids, you won't believe. And to use the tool is, you have to go to school to be part of the league. I knew it was going to get a lot of kids back in school. The incentives are there for the young kids to, you know, not just go to school, help the environment, but also enjoy football as well for what it is. We're going to give the opportunity to some kids who'll be selected to live there. They go to school there, they eat there. It's going to be a completely great opportunity for them to train there twice a day and just really give them the opportunity to get very well educated.
My name is Dennis Cole. I live at Thomas 5 Green Lane in Freetown. I started playing football at the age of 5. The place where I play football, the pitch is just made up of stones. I did not get football boots until I was 9 years old.
I want the Greg Bellamy Foundation help me and to improve my education.
My dream is to play at the World Cup, and I think the Greg Bellamy Foundation can help me achieve this.
Sierra Leone had emerged from a brutal 11-year civil war, characterised by the use of child soldiers and the horrific mutilation of civilians. But years of social, political and economic instability had done nothing to dull the nation's love of football. Craig Bellamy saw an opportunity to make a difference. He had in mind a football academy, but a feasibility study showed that in the absence of a national youth league, it would be difficult to choose players. He funded the project with his own money and additional support from UNICEF. And in May 2009, the Craig Bellamy Foundation League opened for business. Tim Kello, the foundation's CEO, explains how it works.
The league has a unique model that aims to not only get kids to enroll in school, but incentivize them to stay in school, but also encouraging good behavior through the respect of fair play, and encourages kids to deliver health messages and development projects to other kids and youth in their communities. The academy would only ever be up to about 60, 70 children, but our league, about 2,300 kids, the scoring system in our league tells you really what it's about, and that is that a quarter of all the points available in our league are awarded to football, an equal amount, another quarter is given to school attendance, another quarter to good behaviour and fair play, and then another quarter about a community development project. So really, football is just one aspect of the league, but it is probably the strongest aspect in terms of drawing kids into the league.
When you first came to the academy, you shared some of the mainstream development industry's scepticism about the possible role of sport in development projects. What swayed you? What convinced you? Because clearly now you're a very, you know, passionate advocate of that.
I think, yeah, I mean, I think I and others in the mainstream development world were skeptical, largely because, as we've seen a lot in the developing world, you can create a school, but unless you fill it with the right teachers and train those teachers and the right resources, you don't necessarily improve education. In the same way with sport, by creating facilities and having the resources, you aren't necessarily having positive impacts, or certainly not ones that can be measured. But I think in the last 3 or 4 years, this really growing and emerging movement of sport for development has really begun to take the skepticism on board and spend a lot of time and effort monitoring and evaluating the impact that it can have, and to a certain extent proving to the rest of the development world that it really can be a vehicle for positive development change, hence the likes of UNICEF getting on board and others around the world.
Based on what you've seen so far, what's your sense of what sport can achieve that perhaps traditional development policies can't?
Well, I think it is that convening power, this sense of sport pulling kids into positive pro-social connections, into positive development projects, rather than previously the focus was really sort of pushing them into it. Sport has a way of drawing kids in, and once they're in there, you know, their attention can be diverted into making healthy choices. But also, I think that sport really has the power as a metaphor for life skills. For instance, when we teach our football teams about teamwork on the pitch can easily be transferred into teamwork in your community, teamwork in your family, teamwork in your country. Likewise, when you're reading the game in a game of football, that can easily be transferred over into reading the situation and the risks that are around in your own neighbourhood. You know, when we talk about in football avoiding tackles, this is a metaphor for avoiding health risks. So using the power of sport, their love of sport, and in Africa especially football, to pass on messages that work both in the sport place but also in life.
Tim Kello there, CEO of the Craig Bellamy Foundation, a project that shows just how powerfully sport can be used in development initiatives. I also spoke to the former Olympic hockey player, Scott Sanderson. He began by telling me about his work for Right to Play.
The easiest thing for me to do is probably explain Right to Play through a game that we play in areas that are affected by malaria. It's called Mosquito Tag. What we'll do is we'll pick two or three kids and we'll say, okay, these guys are the mosquitoes, and they're going to run around and tag you. And when you get tagged, you need to show signs of malaria. So you're tired, you've got stiff joints, you know, you're a bit feverish, and the kids really get into it. So once they've been tagged, they need to keep demonstrating those symptoms of malaria before they're allowed to run around again. So by the end of the first round of the games, you end up with 27 kids who are showing symptoms of malaria. So then you stop the game, you bring them all in, and you ask the kids, okay, what are the symptoms of malaria? Boom, boom, boom. They're able to lay it out to you really quickly, really succinctly. Perfect. It's games like that that are really straightforward and direct, but teach a message through play that gets these kids at a level that they can understand, and it's really, really straightforward for them. So it's not necessarily about, you know, having things up on a chalkboard and writing it down in a long list. It's just a fun way for them to run around, have a good time, but also learn at the same time.
Do you feel it's a good thing for sports to be used as a way of delivering development objectives, or is it just about fun? Should it be about fun?
I think that's an interesting question. It's actually tied hand in hand. I think there's no way to separate the two things, because if you're having fun and you're playing with a purpose, how do you separate those two pieces? We're playing games and playing sport, but it's all with an educational purpose and it all has a message. And so we're about inclusion and bringing everyone together under the same banner. And to separate development from the fun piece is not something that we do at Right to Play. It's all integrated and it's all one thing. So it's sport, play, education, and fun, and it's all tied into one piece.
Scott Sanderson of Right to Play. But can sport also promote social development in less tangible ways? At the London Olympics, women competed for every participating country for the first time in history. Qatar, Brunei, and Saudi Arabia all fielded female athletes, and the Saudi 800-metre runner, Sarah Attar, was in no doubt that her presence at the Games marked a significant moment.
It was such a huge honour to be asked to come and that we were allowed to participate this year. And I just think that it can be something amazing for the women in Saudi Arabia, and that we can really, you know, push through. And everything needs that first initial step. With that first step, then things can follow. So just that we were allowed to come is a huge first step.
Sarah Attar, speaking to CNN after representing Saudi Arabia at the Olympics in the 800 metres. But what long-term difference will Attar's participation make in a country where women are still denied the right to drive, let alone participate in organised sport? Here's Christoph Wilke of Human Rights Watch.
Well, overall, it's not a point of priority for people in Saudi Arabia. There is a greatly increased awareness and outpouring, in particular on the internet, of, let's say, social activism, anywhere from human rights to political reform to social reforms. And participation of Saudi women in the Olympics has attracted attention on a relatively minor scale from people on the Twitter sphere and other internet blogs over the past 6 months.
So what needs to happen to build on the successful participation of those women, at least in the Olympics? Is it on the agenda? Is it on the horizon? Or is this something that's just going to be a passing phase in the history of Saudi Arabian sport?
Well, let me say, I think the International Olympic Committee missed a golden opportunity here, and that was in the run-up to the Olympics to link the very welcome participation of Saudi women to however small changes they can extract from Saudi government officials within the kingdom. The two have to be linked. And right now, the pure symbolism of the participation is no guarantor at all that it will lead to any change inside the kingdom. We've seen a cautious official welcome. We've seen outpouring of support, and even more so of invective against the two Saudi female athletes. But this is all linked to the London Olympics. Few people will have those in mind in a month or two. The pressure for any change will be forgotten then, at least the international pressure and media attention, like the precedence of introducing girls' education, introducing television. Those were the highest level royal decisions by the king, and they set a precedent and they set the tone. And although they weren't entirely smooth, a tone-setting announcement followed by the necessary programs from the king would be able to achieve quite a lot.
Christoph Wilke of Human Rights Watch there, with a clear message that change starts from the top. And with that in mind, let's turn to Ghana, where a British leadership programme is harnessing sport to create a new generation of Ghanaian leaders. The BUILD programme works through universities in Ghana and is supported by UK Sport. BUILD not only nurtures players, but creates a solid foundation of young people who have sport and leadership skills. This is Derek Chawe, the project's coordinator.
The BUILD programme is an idea from the UK, using sports as a tool to touch lives of people. And for Ghana, what we know is instead of investing into infrastructures and stuff like that, now we rather invest into the children of Ghana, you know, using the sports as a tool to touch their lives and then instill leadership values and experiences within them that they will never forget. So what we do is we use the games, the traditional Ghanaian games, as well as some games from the UK, to teach life essential skills by physical activity and sport. We currently operate in 5 regions out of the 10 regions in Ghana, and our target points are the universities to reach out to the community by talking about some issues like attendance in school, like teenage pregnancy, like sanitation. And what we do is we are careful not to introduce a particular sport that encourages competition. A very good example is football. In Ghana, we have lesser known sports like handball, volley, tennis, table tennis, and all stuff. Are some games that we kind of exploit some of the skills that they use in throwing, catching, kicking, striking in our programs. We use a variety of sports to provide a platform where learning can take place instead of bringing out, let me say, football that is a little bit competitive and students might not get the concept of what we want to do.
So how do the skills of sport translate into leadership skills?
What we do is, in every activity, the activity provides fun in the training that we do. And in the process, we review with the various skills and qualities within one particular activity. And so when we review with them, we ask questions. What went well? What could have been done better? And what skill have you learned and how you can apply it to your educational career or to yourself as a person.
Derek Chawe there, talking about the BUILD programme in Ghana and floating the fascinating suggestion that football may actually be too powerful to work effectively as a development tool, overshadowing the educational side of the programme. Derek's point echoes one made by Ben Parkinson, the director of Social Enterprise Africa, on our Sport and Development Talk Point. Ben's project, based in the Ugandan capital, Kampala, aims to address poverty in Africa through social enterprise. He writes, "Sport needs to be used in conjunction with other activities for children. While there is nothing inherently wrong with running football projects, those running the best ones combine their efforts by providing art, drama, and other activities for children, as ultimately this is about talent development of children, not winning tournaments." And it's worth adding that sport can promote the development of children in its own right. That's exactly what's happening in Cape Town, where a community-initiated youth football project, a night league, is having a positive impact. Police in a notoriously rough part of Khayelitsha Township say crime figures have dropped thanks to Amandla Edu Football, which was started 4 years ago. And the organisers say that by keeping youngsters occupied at weekends, the night league has helped kids to turn their backs on crime and concentrate on their studies. Alex Duval-Smith reports from the AstroTurf.
I was a gangster, like.
Tsedi Kave is from Section S in Khayelitsha Site B. The 16-year-old used to fight with knives. Now as a striker in the township's night league, he prefers to perfect his skills at cutting through the opposition's defence.
A lot of youngsters in our area are infected with crime, so this league is preventing that. Before the night league, every Fridays there were gangsters bullying each other and killing and all those stuff.
The basic idea of Amandla Edu Football, 4 5-a-side AstroTurf pitches in Cape Town's Khayelitsha Township, is to keep youngsters busy at peak crime times. 2,500 teenage girls and boys play in 7 leagues every Friday and Saturday from 8 p.m. until midnight. The teams even have names reminiscent of local gangs.
Excuse me, what's the name of your team?
Singapore.
Singapore?
Yes.
Who are you playing against?
Small town.
Small town, okay.
Started in 2008 by a young German stationed in South Africa for his national service, Amandla Edu Football was here before the World Cup. The initiative was given a clear image boost by celebrity endorsements in 2010, and World Cup Corporation FIFA's charitable arm, Football for Hope, now donates $40,000 a year, 15% of the Khayelitsha Centre's running costs. Last year, a night league was started in Johannesburg, and in a few months' time, 4 more AstroTurf pitches and a community centre are due to open in another Cape Township. The Khayelitsha Community Centre features electric light, computers and the internet. Staff are on hand to counsel, settle disputes and hold team-building workshops.
My name is Noluvuyo Nkazi Dudumashe. I live here inside B Khayelitsha in Cape Town, South Africa, in S section. What we do is we incorporate a topic, like when you talk about self-esteem and respect, those things also apply in football. We find a way to combine them, because when you're playing a football match, you have to respect the ref, you have to respect your opponents. Maybe sometimes he knows the word respect, but doesn't even know how to spell or write the word. So that's what we first do. And then we do a training session regarding respect using the cones and the soccer ball. Then at the end of the session, you sit down with them, talk to them, what did they learn after the session. Then the following day, when we're having them again, just check, or are they still remembering? What must I do next to make sure that they understood exactly what you're trying to do?
What's interesting about this place right now, Khayelitsha on a Friday night, is probably one of the most dangerous places you could be in the world. However, here, there is no alcohol. There are not even any people smoking joints or cigarettes, which is really highly unusual for this part of the world where there's not much else to do but drink on a Friday night if you've got the money for it.
Edu wants to be a professional footballer. He's also so impressed the organisers that he's now being groomed as a youth leader.
It's to help children's home. It's to go there and help the kids who were abandoned by families and go help them.
Are you coaching them, soccer?
Yes, we do coaching and helping them, like wash dishes and all the stuff for them.
What would be your message to young people who are growing up in Khayelitsha, tempted by crime? What would be your message to them?
My message would be crime does not pay, And then it does pay you in somehow, but at the end doesn't pay you.
But isn't it hard to get out of a gang once you're in? Because they you know things. They could kill you.
It's hard to get out, but I chose to get out because I know what's good for me. And in that, I didn't go with, like, I didn't volunteer myself to be a gangster. It was a peer pressure by friends. My message would be, come to Amandla in Khosi Side B, and then you will have fun here.
Police confirm that crime has dropped dramatically in Site B Khayelitsha since Amandla Edu Football began occupying youngsters on Friday and Saturday nights. In a further endorsement of the initiative's success, the International Committee of the Red Cross has signed a 3-year agreement with the group worth more than $200,000. A Red Cross research team is expected soon in Khayelitsha to study the night leagues with a view to incorporating them in conflict prevention programmes around the world.
Alex Duval-Smith reporting from Cape Town. And Alex joins me from Cape Town now. 6 months after the end of South Africa 2010, FIFA President Sepp Blatter said, FIFA will leave a lasting legacy for the youth of South Africa thanks to the successful World Cup. So Alex, has that happened?
There's been a lot of talk, a lot of handing over of certificates and checks. The FIFA Legacy Fund is managed by SAFA, the South African Football Association, which regrettably doesn't have a very good record of passing on investments it receives. That money is supposed to be used for the development of local football. So it's not so much grassroots support for amateur football. It's more going to be used for supporting small leagues and the improvement of the standard of South African football. Then FIFA also have their Football for Hope Fund, which began operating in the run-up to the World Cup, including 20 centres for 2010, which were essentially AstroTurf pitches around the country, mainly five-a-side pitches. One in particular I know of in Khayelitsha Township near Cape Town. It's nice and busy, but it's a five-a-side place and it doesn't have a huge capacity to change lives.
The political rhetoric from President Zuma after the World Cup was really quite positive. He said the event had reaffirmed a common South African and African identity, that it had boosted the national economy, and that it was a source of national pride. I mean, are any of those factors relevant here?
I think the World Cup did unite South Africans of all races, and I think it did give everybody a common purpose for a time. Definitely.
But you would presumably, by the tone of what you're saying, suggest that the supposed economic benefits, the improvements in social infrastructure and so on, haven't quite hit the target.
Absolutely, they haven't hit the target. I mean, and I'm not alone in saying so, a trade unionist called Eddie Cottle edited a book that came out earlier this year, South Africa's World Cup, A Legacy for Whom? And I spoke to him at the launch of the book. I mean, he actually argues, and I'll let you listen to a soundbite here, the World Cup, if anything, exacerbated the differences in South African society.
The World Cup really reinforced spatial inequality. That where you had major infrastructure, including stadiums, they polarized South Africa both in race and class terms. The second aspect is that there was no real trickle down to ordinary workers. What you had really was an increase in exploitation. Workers worked longer hours and harder to step up productivity for the World Cup. In the tourism sector, there was hardly people being employed because of the fact that FIFA bungled the bookings during the World Cup. Thirdly, the fact that we did not pressurize FIFA enough to make certain concessions, even if it was at least 5 or 10% taxation levels. But to have to stoop so low, to even freeze hospitality accommodation to minus 20% from the norm was unthinkable. I think the last and final aspect is the fact that we did not really have any kind of redistributive strategy of how a World Cup could, in fact, actually work in the interest of the populace. The only model where there was an attempt to do that was in Cape Town, which was to have the World Cup at Athlone Stadium. And that very attempt to have at least some kind of development spin-off in terms of jobs directly to the communities, in terms of developing an infrastructure and transport corridor to working class communities, to upgrade the stadium, to allow neighborhood restaurants and hospitality accommodation to benefit from the World Cup, did not transpire because FIFA did not like the view of working class neighborhoods during a 3.5 billion audience.
So, Alex, I mean, looking beyond the 2010 World Cup, obviously the Africa Cup of Nations is a biannual event. It's been staged in a variety of African cities, Egypt, Ghana, Angola, and most recently Gabon, Equatorial Guinea shared the 2012 tournament. Surely that brings some benefit to those countries.
The big sporting events do bring benefits to the construction industry in particular. You find large contracts being awarded, sometimes in a tender process, which is questionable, for the construction of stadiums, for the improvement of sporting infrastructure, for the construction of accommodation for the visiting teams. This year, for example, Gabon's hosting of the African Cup of Nations was an excuse for the government to spend millions on buying crowd control equipment, armoured vehicles from South Africa, in fact, and riot gear for the police. None of that, I think, one can regard as development or positive development for a country. More a question of an exercise in vanity.
Alex Duval-Smith. And someone else who has been considering the economic impact of sport is Andrew Zimbalist of Smith College in the USA, a prominent sports economist. I asked him whether sport has a role to play in long-term economic development.
Based upon the independent studies that have been done by economists, and I stress independent, those studies suggest that with a few possible exceptions, that there is not a synergy between economic development and sports.
So bearing in mind some of the drawbacks and the pitfalls, what do you think is the solution in terms of, I mean, if you were Rio, you're hosting the 2014 World Cup and the 2016 Olympics. What does the city need to do to avoid those pitfalls and ensure there are benefits to long-term economic development?
Well, it's very easy to outline what they need to do. The problem is that the way politics are organized these days, it's very difficult to accomplish what that outline might suggest. But I also think that there's underlying structural problem that needs to be dealt with. And that structural problem with regard to the Olympics is that the IOC is a monopolist. And the structural problem with regard to the World Cup is that FIFA is a monopolist. And as monopolists, what they have been able to do is to say to the cities of the world, okay, fight against each other and produce the most elaborate, spectacular bid that you can, and then we'll choose the one that we like the best. That's simplifying it, obviously, but that's what happens, basically. And so cities bid and bid and bid until they evaporate and sometimes over-evaporate any economic gain that might have been there. And so as long as you have this structural situation of monopolists causing the cities of the world to bid against each other, you're going to get these kinds of outcomes. And I think also, by the way, there are environmental and sustainability questions with all of the building that goes on. Some of the facilities are temporary, but you're going to get a lot of very expensive facilities that are not temporary, that are permanent, that not only take up scarce, valuable urban real estate for decades and decades, but they cost millions of dollars to keep up, and they cost hundreds of millions of dollars to build. One possible solution would simply be for the IOC to declare that all future Summer Olympics are going to be held in Athens. There are a lot of ways in the abstract to talk about making the situation better. The question is, what reasonable solutions or remedies are available on a practical basis?
Andrew Zimbalist there. And lastly, let's hear from Dr. Simon Darnell of Durham University, author of the recent book Sport for Development and Peace, A Critical Sociology. I asked Simon if his research had led him to believe sport can play a role in development initiatives.
I certainly think that there are good examples of sport being successful in meeting some of the development goals. But at the same time, for those of us that study sport and study sport critically, the idea that sport is sort of an inherent force for good is contestable at the very least. And I think, to me, that's one of the real limitations of the discourses that we see about sport for development, is that we sort of regularly talk about this kind of inherent positivity in sport. And there are wonderful things about sport, but there are also some really less positive, shall we say, elements of sport. And I think sometimes our rush to talk about the successes of sport for development tends to encourage us to overlook or oversee some of the limitations. So I think it's contextual. I think in some cases sport definitely has some things to offer, but this idea that it's going to solve all of our problems is one that we need to pay attention to.
Can you give us some examples of some of the more negative elements that you refer to?
Well, I think in general terms, and this comes from my work in a Department of International Development Studies, I think in general terms, sport for development is not learning from the limitations of traditional development and traditional development orthodoxy. And a couple of examples of that is I think we're really, in our rush to mobilize sport for development, we're perpetuating the stewardship of the developing world, of the third world, of whatever sort of term you want to use, and all those terms are, I understand, are loaded and come with baggage. But we're sort of lapsing back into these old narratives and these old relationships where the third world is sort of at the beck and call of the first world in determining how development should go. One of the negative examples is just the fact that by positioning sport as a new way to do development, we're actually falling back into old patterns of how development has operated over the last 50 or 60 years. Sports mega events, and that includes, you know, the Olympics and the World Cup as the two major examples, are now being positioned or articulated in a way that these are supposed to be examples of development. But in many ways, this is sort of making us think about development as basically modernization, as the fact that South Africa is an underdeveloped country, and if they have more facilities, if they have more economic activity, if they have more infrastructure, then therefore they will be a developed country. And sport is one of the ways in which we're sort of now trying to make that development happen. But that concept of development as modernization or as development as simply the building of new buildings, that's an outmoded and outdated understanding of development, I would argue, at the very least, because I think we've reached a point in the resources of the planet where, you know, developing the whole planet into this high-end infrastructure is probably just not simply going to work for issues of climate change and the environment and those kinds of things. So attaching sport to development has encourage us to overlook some of these limitations of traditional development. And I think that kind of notion of just turning the third world into a new first world is an example of that through these kinds of sports mega events.
Huge sporting events like the next Olympics in Rio promise great things for the poor. Do they ever deliver?
The evidence is that a lot of people are paying the price for the development that Rio 2016 is requiring. And it's not just, you know, footing the bill through tax money. It's also displacement of people living in the favelas. It's the environmental cost, even though ostensibly Rio 2016, their bid book, has the most environmentally friendly propositions and goals of the history of the Olympics. But my general argument is that I think we've reached a point where it's nearly impossible, given how much money is being spent on some of these events, for them to be worth it, you know, in financial or social costs, for that matter. The price to be paid for poor people is very high.
Should we be similarly skeptical then about the role of celebrity sports people and when they set up foundations to promote development? Do they have a role to play?
Well, they do have a role to play, but I sometimes lament what role it is that they're playing. I mean, I think that they could really draw attention to some of these issues. An athlete like Steve Nash, for example, has done that. He's spoken out not only about the need for increasing charity, but the need to think about how and why some of these problems come about. John Amici is another really good example of some of the work that he does in Manchester. He's not just asking for people to donate money, but he's also talking about the need for some kind of structural change, for some kind of rethink about the role of sport and about some of the how some of these social problems come to be in the first place. So it would make a big difference if athletes moved more towards drawing attention to particular issues rather than just collecting money for their charitable foundation.
Dr. Simon Darnell. So can sport play a useful role in development? Clearly, the issues are complex. But initiatives like the Craig Bellamy Foundation and the Build Project in Ghana suggest that the right project in the right place can make a positive difference, certainly in terms of social development. Whether major events like the World Cups and the Olympics can benefit those at the bottom is much more debatable. But the mere fact that we place such faith in the transformative power of sport in the first place says a lot about our tacit belief in its ability to do good. I'm Lesley Panerine. The producer was Ian Chambers. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.